Forgotten Classics, where a good story never goes out of style.
Hello, everyone. I'm Julie, and here we have episode 139 of Forgotten Classics. The end of the preliminary stuff for Genesis. Yay! But first, let's have the podcast highlight. Except this week, it is not a podcast highlight. I have for you instead two really wonderful books from LibriVox. They are recorded by Ruth Golding, who is a true treasure. She has a wonderful voice, a wonderful way of reading, and she can do voices like nobody's business. Oh my gosh. Okay, so what are the books? The first one is Cleek, Man of 40 Faces. The second is another Cleek book, The Riddle of the Purple Emperor. The Man of 40 Faces is the first book. It, of course, features Cleek, who is a master criminal. He has the ability to mold his face subtly so that it looks so different that he's unrecognizable and, in fact, looks like a completely different person. He's got a gang. They're all set up. They're pulling off these wonderful heists. We see them in the middle of one. That's how we're introduced. And then, in the middle of a different heist, he sees that fatal downfall for many a master criminal, especially from stories from around the beginning of the 1900s. A beautiful and virtuous woman who makes him want to change his ways so he can show her that he is worthy of her if she would even deign to glance in his direction. So the rest of the book is a series of short stories in which Cleek is working undercover, so to speak, with the head of the police to solve these very obscure mysteries. They are absolutely wonderful. And then through it all, we have the overarching theme of him wanting to earn the love of this good woman, who gradually becomes more and more interested in him because, let's face it, how flattering is that? Come on. Now, of course, you can also find this book, which is, by the way, if you want to look by author, by Thomas W. Hanshew. You can find it at Project to Gutenberg for free, where I'm pretty sure they have the ebook done there. So if you want to download it that way, or a PDF or HTML, LibriVox, because you can enjoy Ruth Golding's fabulous narration, or I'm sure a regular bookstore. The second book is a Cleek book also, called The Riddle of the Purple Emperor. And the difference here is twofold. One, it's by Thomas W. Hanshew and Mary E. Hanshew. So it's a collaborative effort. And also, it's a full-length novel. We don't have it broken up into the little short stories. And I've got to say, I'm almost done with it. This plot is twisting and turning and doubling back. And there were a few things I've guessed up front. But it is simply delightful. The Purple Emperor is the name of a fabulous gem, which a young girl inherits when she turns 18. She has a crabby old aunt. She has a young man in love with her, who, of course, is from the Romeo and Juliet style family, which the aunt despises. And so you've got the love story. You have the disappearing gem, because otherwise would it be a mystery? You have a murder that's not a murder. And I'm just going to leave you with that part yourself. You can find out about that. And Cleek is frankly scratching his head with frustration, but I believe he's seeing his way clear to the end. So try these two books. They are wonderful period pieces. They're beautifully read. And to top it all off, they're actually very good mysteries, despite being period pieces. So enjoy. Now, returning to Genesis by Robert Alter. I will just upfront say this comment about pronunciation in Hebrew. I said it all in episode 1, so you can go listen to that again. I really, really appreciate the people like Pervonen, who says, "Much of the Hebrew is workable. I can understand why you'd choose to spell letter by letter, of words such as M-E apostrophe O-R or others where the syllable break is between vowels. Still, it makes me stop and reassemble the word in my head, and by the time I'm ready, you are far ahead. Don't worry, I'll manage. I really appreciate that very cheerful acceptance of the fact that this is just going to be a struggle, and if we ever want to get through it, we're going to have to go with it. For those of you who my Hebrew is causing pain, I apologize, but I would like to point out again that the book is available. It's probably much better read and absorbed that way, and I'm doing my best, and that's all I can do. I only have so much time to devote. Well, there you have it. We're just kind of hampered that way. Now, the body of this episode I recorded last week before I saw the comment about spelling versus saying. And frankly, as you can tell, I've been going back and forth. So I think what I'll be doing in the future for the commentary is I will say the word to my terrible best, and then I will spell it. That hopefully will help people put it together, and we can go on from there. Now, finally, the end of the commentary. We've heard all about the translation and the reasoning behind it, and frankly, it has made me appreciate good translation of foreign works that I've read. This next section is called About the Commentary. As you can imagine, in a book this old, and a book where translation is such an issue, understanding cultural events, the context for their frame of mind, or what the authors are trying to convey is going to be really important. That's where Robert Alter's commentary comes in. And do not worry, because what I'm going to do when I read it, and I may have told you all this before, but guess what? This time we'll all remember it, because once for the heart and once for the head, is that it? Anyway, you can't repeat it too many times, I always think. Is that I will be reading each chapter by itself, just straight out, without any commentary. So you can hear it the way that you would just hear it if it was just the story. Then I will go back and read the comments. I have not yet decided if I'm going to read the commentary after each chapter, and we'll have more than one chapter, or if I'll read all the chapters in a row and then read the commentary. If anybody has any preferences on that, let me know. Right now, I'm leaning towards reading all the chapters that we'll be discussing or listening to, and then going back and doing all the commentary. And I do not mind reading sentences or pieces or even the whole chapter again with the commentary if I need to, so that we can all get the context. Maybe this is too complicated. I don't know. But that's what I've been thinking about. Okay, let's go on. Let's hear what Robert Alter has to say about the commentary he adds and why. Let's dive in. I'll meet you on the other side. Genesis. Translation and Commentary by Robert Alter. Published by W.W. Norton. This book is under copyright with all rights reserved. Go to the episode show notes for contact information concerning this book. Many thanks to Robert Alter and his publisher for granting Forgotten Classics the non-exclusive rights to read this work. To the reader, 2. Genesis as a book. All that I have said about the style of Genesis, as well as most of what I have to say in my commentary about the details of the narrative, presupposes that Genesis is a coherent book, what we moderns would think of as a work of literature. But as many readers may be aware, 2 centuries of biblical scholarship have generally assumed that Genesis, and indeed most biblical texts, is not strictly speaking a book, but rather an accretion of sundry traditions shot through with disjunctions and contradictions and accumulated in an uneven editorial process over several centuries. There are knotty issues of the dating and the evolution of the text that have been debated by generations of scholars and that I shall not pretend to resolve, but I do think that the historical and textual criticism of the Bible is not so damaging to a literary reading of the text as is often assumed. The biblical conception of a book was clearly far more open-ended than any notion current in our own culture, with its assumptions of known authorship and legal copyright. The very difference in the technology of bookmaking is emblematic. For us, a book is a printed object boxed in between two covers, with title and author emblazoned on the front cover and year of publication indicated on the copyright page. The biblical term that comes closest to book is sefer. Etymologically, it means something recounted, but its primary sense is scroll, and it can refer to anything written on a scroll, a letter, a relatively brief unit within a longer composition, or a book more or less in our own sense. A scroll is not a text shut in between covers, and additional swaths of scroll can be stitched onto it, which seems to have been a very common biblical practice. A book in the biblical sphere was assumed to be a product of anonymous tradition. The only ones in the biblical corpus that stipulate the names of their authors in superscriptions at the beginning are the prophetic books. But even in this case, later prophecies by different prophet poets could be tacked onto the earlier scrolls, and the earlier scrolls perhaps might even be edited to better fit into a continuous book with the later accretions. Let me say just a few words about the different strands that are detectable in Genesis, and then I shall explain why I make very little of them in my commentary. Since well back into the 19th century, it has been the consensus of biblical scholarship that Genesis, together with the next three books of the Pentateuch, is woven together from three distinct literary sources, or documents. The Yahwistic document, spelled with an initial capital J in German and hence designated as J, the Eloistic document, E, and the priestly document, P. Most scholars have concluded that J and E are considerably earlier than P, which could be as late as the 6th or 5th century BCE, the period after the return from the Babylonian exile. According to one view, J would be a product of the 10th century BCE, early in the Davidic dynasty, and E perhaps a century later. Another common position is that J and E are roughly contemporary, the latter having been composed in the northern kingdom Israel, the former in the southern kingdom Judea. Scholars identify the different sources on the basis of different names used for the deity, emblematically YHWH in J and Elohim in E, on the basis of certain stylistic features, and by virtue of what are claimed to be different ideological and historical assumptions. It is generally thought that the three sources were redacted into a single text quite early in the period of the return to Zion, perhaps in priestly circles. This rapid summary may make matters sound pat, but in fact all the details of the documentary hypothesis are continually and often quite vehemently debated. There are strong differences of opinion about the dating of the various sources, especially J and E. Serious questions have been raised as to whether either J or E is the work of a single writer or school, and various scholars have contended that in fact there is a J1, J2, J3, and so forth. Enormous energy has been invested in discriminating the precise boundaries between one document and the next, but disagreement on minute identifications continue to abound. One scholar will break down a particular text into an alternation between J and E, with an occasional conflation of the two and perhaps a brief intrusion from P, seeking to refine the documentary categories phrase by phrase, while another will call the whole passage an authentic production of J. I should add that efforts to distinguish between J and E on stylistic grounds have been quite unconvincing. It is small wonder that the documentary hypothesis, whatever its general validity, has begun to look as though it has reached a point of diminishing returns, and many younger scholars, showing signs of restlessness with source criticism, have been exploring other approaches, literary, anthropological, sociological, and so forth, to the Bible. The informing assumption of my translation and commentary is that the edited version of Genesis, the so-called redacted text, which has come down to us, though not without certain limited contradictions and disparate elements, has powerful coherence as a literary work, and that this coherence is above all what we need to address as readers. One need not claim that Genesis is a unitary artwork, like, say, a novel by Henry James, in order to grant it integrity as a book. There are other instances of works of art that evolve over the centuries, like the cathedrals of medieval Europe, and are the product of many hands, involving an elaborate process of editing, like some of the greatest Hollywood films. From where we stand, it is difficult to know to what extent the biblical redactors felt free to modify or reshape their inherited sources, and to what extent they felt obliged to reproduce them integrally, permitting themselves only an occasional editorial bridge or brief gloss. What seems quite clear, however, is that the redactors had a strong and often subtle sense of thematic and narrative purposefulness in the way they wove together the inherited literary strands, and the notion of some scholars that they were actuated by a mechanical compulsion to incorporate old traditions at all costs is not sustained by a scrutiny of the text, with only a few marginal exceptions. It is quite apparent that a concept of composite artistry, of literary composition through a collage of textual materials, was generally assumed to be normal procedure in ancient Israelite culture. The technique of collage could come into play at two stages. A writer in the first instance might feel free to introduce into his own narrative, as an integral textual unit, a genealogy, an etiological tale, an ethnographic table, or a vestige of a mythological story, or perhaps to recreate one of the aforementioned without an explicit textual source. Then the redactor, in shaping the final version of the text, could place disparate textual materials at junctures that would give the completed text the thematic definition or the large formal punctuation he sought. I am deeply convinced that conventional biblical scholarship has been trigger-happy in using the arsenal of text-critical categories, proclaiming contradiction wherever there is the slightest internal tension in the text, seeing every repetition as evidence of a duplication of sources, everywhere tuning in to the static of transmission, not to the complex music of the redacted story. The reader will consequently discover that this commentary refers only occasionally and obliquely to the source analysis of Genesis. For even where such analysis may be convincing, it seems to me a good deal less interesting than the subtle workings of the literary whole represented by the redacted text. As an attentive reader of other works of narrative literature, I have kept in mind that there are many kinds of ambiguity and contradiction, and abundant varieties of repetition that are entirely purposeful, and that are essential features of the distinctive vehicle of literary experience. I have constantly sought, in both the translation and the commentary, to make this biblical text accessible as a book to be read, which is surely what was intended by its authors and redactors. To that end, I discovered that some of the medieval Hebrew commentators were often more helpful than nearly all the modern ones, with their predominantly text-critical and historical concerns. Rashi, acronym for Rabbi Shlomo Ishtaki, 1080 to 1174, France, and Abraham ibn Ezra, 1092 to 1167, migrated from Spain to Italy, France, and England, are the most often cited here. They are two of the great readers of the Middle Ages, and there is still much we can learn from them. A few brief remarks about the structure of Genesis as a book are in order. Genesis comprises two large literary units, the primeval history, chapters 1 to 11, and the patriarchal tales, chapters 12 to 50. The two differ not only in subject, but to some extent in style and perspective. The approach to the history of Israel and Israel's relationship with God that will be the material of the rest of the Hebrew Bible is undertaken through gradually narrowing concentric circles. First, an account of the origins of the world, of the vegetable and animal kingdom, and of humankind. Then, a narrative explanation of the origins of all the known peoples, from Greece to Africa to Mesopotamia and Asia Minor, and of the primary institutions of civilization, including the memorable fable about the source of linguistic division. The Mesopotamian family of Terah is introduced at the end of this universal history in chapter 11, and then when God calls Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldees at the beginning of chapter 12, we move on to the story of the beginnings of the Israelite nation, though the national focus of the narrative is given moral depth because the universal perspective of the first part of Genesis is never really forgotten. Some critics have plausibly imagined this whole large process of biblical literature as a divine experiment with the quirky and unpredictable stuff of human freedom, an experiment plagued by repeated failure and dedicated to renewed attempts. First Adam and Eve, then the generation of Noah, then the builders of the Tower of Babel, and finally Abraham and his seed. Although the creation story with which the primeval history begins does look forward to the proliferation of humanity and the human conquest of the natural world, by and large the first 11 chapters of Genesis are concerned with origins, not eventualities, with the past, not the future. He was the first of all who play on the lyre and pipe. 421, the narrator says of Jubal, one of the antediluvians. The literal phrasing of the Hebrew here, as in a series of analogous verses, is, he was the father of. That idiom is emblematic of the primeval history, which is really a record of the archetypal fathers, a genealogy of human institutions and of ethnic and linguistic identity. Although the patriarchal tales are in one obvious way also the story of a chain of fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the horizon these tales constantly invoke is the future, not the past. God repeatedly tells Abraham what he intends to do with and for the offspring of Abraham in time to come, both in the impending near future of Egyptian enslavement and in the long-term future of national greatness. It is perfectly apt that the patriarchal tales should conclude with Jacob's deathbed poem envisaging the destiny of the future tribes of Israel, which he prefaces with the words, "Gather round, that I may tell you what shall befall you in the days to come." 49:1. The primeval history, in contrast to what follows in Genesis, cultivates a kind of narrative that is fable-like or legendary, and sometimes residually mythic. The human actors in these stories are kept at a certain distance and seem more generalized types than individual characters with distinctive personal histories. The style tends much more than that of the patriarchal tales to formal symmetries, refrain-like repetitions, parallelisms, and other rhetorical devices of a prose that often aspires to the dignity of poetry, or that invites us to hear the echo of epic poetry in its cadences. As everywhere in biblical narrative, dialogue is an important vehicle, but in the primeval history it does not have the central role it will play later, and one finds few of the touches of vivid mimesis that make dialogue in the patriarchal tales so brilliant an instrument for the representation of human, and human and divine, interactions. In sum, this rapid report of the distant early stages of the human story adopts something of a distancing procedure in the style and the narrative modes with which it tells the story. God's very first words to Abraham at the beginning of chapter 12 enjoin him to abandon land, birthplace, and father's house. These very terms, or at least this very sphere, will become the arena of the narrative to the end of Genesis. The human creature is now to be represented not against the background of the heavens and the earth and civilization as such, but rather within the tense and constricted theater of the paternal domain, in tent and wheatfield and sheepfold, in the minute rhythms of the quotidian existence, working out all hopes of grand destiny in the coil of familial relationships, the internecine, sometimes deadly, warring of brothers and fathers and sons and wives. In keeping with this major shift in focus from the primeval history to the patriarchal tales, style and narrative mode shift as well. The studied formality of the first 11 chapters, epitomized in the symmetries and the intricate repetition of word and sound in the story of the Tower of Babel, gives way to a more flexible and varied prose. Dialogue is accorded more prominence and embodies a more lively realism. When, for example, Sarai gives Abram her slave girl Hagar as a concubine, and the proudly pregnant Hagar then treats her with disdain, the matriarch berates her husband in the following fashion. "This outrage is against me because of you. I myself put my slave girl in your embrace, and when she saw she had conceived, I became slight in her eyes." 16:5. Sarai's first sentence here has an explosive compactness in the Hebrew, being only two words, Hamasai Aleka, that resists translation. In any case, these lines smoldering with the fires of female resentment convey a sense of living speech and complexity of feeling and relationship one does not encounter before the patriarchal tales. The frustrated, long-barren wife at cross-purposes with herself and with her husband, first aspiring to maternity through the surrogate of her slave girl, then, after the fact of her new co-wife's pregnancy, tasting a new humiliation, indignant at the slave's presumption, who has been only the instrument of her will. Such vivid immediacy in the representation of the densely problematic nature of individual lives in everyday settings is an innovation not only in comparison with the primeval history, but also in comparison with virtually all of ancient literature. What nevertheless strongly binds the two large units of the book of Genesis is both outlook and theme. The unfolding history of the family that is to become the people of Israel is seen, as I have suggested, as the crucial focus of a larger universal history. The very peregrinations of the family back and forth between Mesopotamia and Canaan and down to Egypt intimate that its scope involves not just the land Israel that has been promised, but the wider reach of known cultures. National existence, moreover, is emphatically imagined as a strenuous effort to renew the act of creation. The creation story repeatedly highlights the injunction to be fruitful and multiply, while the patriarchal tales, in the very process of frequently echoing this language of fertility from the opening chapters, makes it clear that procreation, far from being an automatic biological process, is fraught with dangers, is constantly under the threat of being deflected or cut off. Abraham must live long years with the seeming mockery of a divine promise of numberless offspring as he and his wife advance childless into hoary old age. Near the end of the book, Jacob's whole family fears it may perish in the great famine, and Jacob must assure his brothers that God has sent him ahead of them to Egypt in order to sustain life. Genesis begins with the making of heaven and earth and all life, and ends with the image of a mummy, Joseph's, in a coffin. But implicit in the end is the promise of more life to come, of irrepressible procreation, and that renewal of creation will be manifested even under the weight of oppression at the beginning of Exodus. Genesis then works with disparate materials, puts together its story with two large and very different building blocks, but nevertheless achieves the cohesiveness, the continuity of theme and motif, and the sense of completion of an architectonically conceived book. Although it looks forward to its sequel, it stands as a book, inviting our attention as an audience that follows the tale from beginning to end. About the commentary. My original intention had been simply to provide brief translator's notes. Puns, wordplay in the sundry naming speeches, and other untranslatable maneuvers of the Hebrew needed to be glossed. The reader also had to be informed, I felt, of the occasional junctures where I adopted a reading that varied from the Masoretic text, the received Hebrew text of the Bible. Similarly, It seemed proper to offer some explanation for translation choices that were likely to surprise either the general reader or the scholarly reader, or both. In some instances, such a choice reflects a proposed new solution to a crux in the Hebrew text. More often, it is an effort to represent a more precise understanding of the Hebrew than previous translations have shown. E.g., the Tree of Knowledge is lovely to look at, not lovely to impart wisdom. Pharaoh puts a golden collar around Joseph's neck, not a gold chain. And most pervasively, the little surprises in the translation are attempts to find English equivalents for the nuances of implication and the significant changes of diction in the Hebrew that have not been much regarded by previous translators. Finally, since this translation is, within the limits of readable English style, quite literal, not out of fundamentalist principles, but in an effort to reproduce some of the distinctive literary effects of the original, when the interests of English intelligibility compelled me to diverge from a literal translation, I have alerted readers to the divergence and given the literal sense of the Hebrew words in a note. And beyond all such considerations of word choice and level of style, I thought it necessary to offer succinct explanations of some of the ancient Near Eastern cultural practices and social institutions that are presupposed by the narratives, for without an understanding of them, it is sometimes hard to see exactly what is going on in the story. This last category of explanation is, of course, standard fare in modern Bible commentaries, and is admittedly here as an aid for the relatively uninitiated. But as I got caught up once again in this endlessly fascinating text, it struck me that there were important features of Genesis that by and large had been given short shrift in the modern commentaries. In fact, a good many of my observations on stylistic choices already shaded into a discussion of the literary vehicle of the biblical narratives, and this was the point at which the tightly cinched annotation began to loosen its bonds and reach out to commentary. There were whole orders of questions, it seemed to me, that had been neglected or addressed only intermittently and impressionistically by the modern commentators. Where are there detectable shifts of stylistic level in the Hebrew, and why do they occur? What are the reasons for the small poetic insets in the prose narratives? What are the principles on which dialogue is organized, and how are the speakers differentiated? Where and why are there shifts from the narrator's point of view to that of one of the characters? What are the devices of analogy, recurrent motifs, and key words that invite us to link and contrast one episode with another? And does Genesis, granted its composite origins, exhibit overarching thematic and structural unities or lines of development? On all these challenging questions, I have surely not said the last word. Rather, I have aspired to say some helpful first words in a commentary that I have sought to hold to modest proportions. Clearly, there is no way of separating a literary illumination of the biblical text from a confrontation with philological issues on the one side, and, perhaps more indirectly, with historical issues on the other. In any case, the explanation of Genesis as literary expression is the central focus of this commentary, and I would hope it would be of interest to everyone, from reader at large to scholar, who is drawn to the imaginative liveliness, the complexities, and the sheer narrative inventiveness of these splendid ancient stories. Acknowledgements. For an undertaking as audacious as a new translation of Genesis, I felt particularly dependent on the counsel and encouragement of the friends who read my drafts. Thomas G. Rosenmeyer and Leonard Nathan looked at sections of the manuscript and raised some astute questions. The translation and commentary in their entirety were read by three people. Michael Bernstein's enthusiasm, coming from a reader with so discriminating a sense of English style, did a great deal to allay my own early doubts about the conception of Bible translation I was trying to carry out. Stanley Burnshaw, with an editorial eye that is virtually legendary in American publishing, ferreted out misusages, clunky clauses, and logical gaps in the commentary, and also compelled me to reconsider some of my local choices in the translation. My greatest debt is owed to Amos Funkenstein, whose presence I will continue to miss sorely and to whose memory this book is dedicated. Amos, a great historian and also a brilliant Hebraist, brought to the scrutiny of philological and exegetical problems the same rare lucidity and the same ability to think out old issues in entirely fresh ways that he evinced in his far-ranging studies in intellectual history. When he disagreed with me, he did so vigorously, sometimes vehemently, but also in a spirit of friendly intellectual challenge and with a reiterated admiration for what I was doing that means more to me than I can say. Secretarial and research costs were covered by income from the class of 1937, Chair of Hebrew and Comparative Literature at the University of California at Berkeley. I am grateful to Janet Livingstone for her patient devotion to the arduous task of transferring my handwritten drafts to a computer. Okay, now we've got the lowdown on the translation, Genesis as a book. By the way, I really enjoyed having that reminder of the ancient notion of books versus our notion of books. I have come across this before during Bible studies or other historical sort of reading. And it's always good to remember that just because we judge something one way, that's not how the ancient people were judging it. And that's, you know, very important for having the right context to understand it in. I also loved the very quick history of biblical scholarship. And I think, again, what he's talking about throughout all of this and what you are hopefully going to notice that I did when I was reading this is the immediacy and that everyday life notion that Alter talks about so comes through in this translation. You feel like you know these people. And that's important because, as I keep saying, people essentially don't change. And if you take nothing else away, that's not a bad thing to take away, I think. We tend to think of people from ancient times as being so simple, not being able to understand a lot of the more complex emotions we might feel, not feeling as deeply. That's just not true. They did. And Genesis is here to show us how. I had a very interesting conversation with Rose, our youngest daughter, who's at college in Chicago right now. She is taking a required English course in, I think it's ancient European literature, or maybe it's just ancient literature. Anyway, but in the course of this, so far, they've read the Epic of Gilgamesh, the Book of Genesis, and the Book of Job. And these are whatever portions were reprinted in their overall English book. But we wound up having a very interesting conversation about the differences between Genesis and the book of Job and the point that's being gotten across about not only human nature, but man's relationship with God, what's being pointed out in the different places. And I was telling her about, of course, reading Genesis, which she knew I was going to do, but she didn't know I was doing it right now. Because, as most podcasters will tell you, just like everybody else, nobody in my family listens to this. So, but what that brought up for us after that conversation was, how do you look at a piece of literature that is so intertwined with religion as a piece of literature? She was saying that it's very helpful to remember that it's about religion, but not to apply it to your own particular religion right at the moment. And that's very important. Anybody, of course, can do that and is free to do that during this process. I'm going to try to not bring stuff like that up personally, but I think it's going to be very interesting to see where this takes us as a whole. For example, I had a very interesting series of emails with Rabbi Paula from Torah Threads, who I told you about last time. And she said, I was thinking that I am not certain that people could really get the sense of Alter's statements in the section about light slash seed, etc., if they don't know one really important thing about the Hebrew language. Hebrew words are all derived from three-letter roots, to which prefixes and suffixes are added to make tense, verbal forms, nouns, etc. So, for instance, the root meaning open is P-T-H, patach. If you add an M to the front of it, you get M-A-F-T-E-A-C-H, which is a key. This has been used really nicely in modern Hebrew to make new words. My favorite is the root H-S-V, chashav, which is the root for think. Following the pattern of adding an M to the front to make an object, the Modern Language Institute created meshev, which is the Hebrew word for an object that thinks, better known in translation as a computer. While this is probably still unintelligible for those who can neither see nor read Hebrew, I thought it was too nifty to keep to myself. And I'm so glad she didn't. I love that flexibility within the language. And also, it goes back to what Robert Alter was saying about how Genesis, at least in certain parts of it, has such basic vocabulary, but it's used so flexibly and creatively. That's the very same thinking that Rabbi Paula is telling us about. I just love that. Also, she says, someday we have to have a conversation about Jewish science fiction, which, of course, I told her I've heard of an anthology like that, and she promptly responded, Wandering Stars. And I think there's a second one she told me about called More Wandering Stars. So if you're interested in looking that up, do. I put it on my to-read list, which is as long as my arm, if not longer, but we're not going to go there. Somehow the science fiction always gets moved toward the front, you know. So that is all the conversation about the book to this point. By the way, I do apologize for missing an episode last week. It's that time of year where I have that huge annual project and it's already getting away from me. So I will do my best not to go off track again. But I'm back to working nights and going to start working weekends and do not have tons of help right at this point. Hopefully I'll get more later. So I'm a little preoccupied with that. Now for a touch more Halloween listening, we have the Bowery Boys, who I told you about last week. They put out their Supernatural Stories of New York, the fourth annual episode. So you can listen to a current one if you didn't get a chance to go back and look at the ones I was mentioning in their archives. Also, there's a podcast I listen to that's relatively new called Medieval Archives Podcast. They have their Fortress Friday, and they've been having haunted castles. It's a six-part series that they're trying to get done by Halloween, and I think there are four castles up so far. So I'll put the link, but do go listen. They're fairly short, so they don't take a long time. And at this point, I think that's it. I'm trying hard to get this up at the beginning of this week, so you have a chance to listen to any of that Halloween stuff at the end. As always, I appreciate any comments, so please do write or email me. You can find the comments box for this episode and my email in the sidebar of the blog for the podcast, hcforgottenclassics.blogspot.com. You may also find groups for us at Goodreads, Library Things, and Ravelry. Ravelry's is called Good Yarns. And iTunes Reviews. Haven't had any lately, but they're always fun if somebody takes the time to do them. So don't forget that option. Joseph also tells me we're one step closer to having that Grimm's fairy tale in. Yep, I'm getting excited. Hope you are too. So if you see that drop in there, you'll know where it's from. I'm going to try to get back on track with the episodes because now we're getting ready for In the Beginning. I'm looking forward to it, everybody. Hope you've enjoyed this so far. I really appreciate everybody coming by to listen. It makes it really much more interesting for me, and I hope it does for you too. Have a great week. Have a happy and a not too scary Halloween, and I'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.